course. The first poet tonight is David Kluhl. The first thing we notice about Kluhl's poems, either listening tonight or on the page, is his voice. His long lines reach back to Whitman, Ginsberg, and the Beats, spilling into the margins as a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings recollected in the heat and wonder of the moment. His is a distinctly American voice. It is casual and unfussy. It is the voice of the wise ass at the end of the neighborhood bar, the voice of the conspiracy theorist and the vegetable man in the alley. It's an honest voice trying to make sense of a dishonest world that garbles late-night TV and TV news, smart bombs, dumb-luck Republicans, bureaucrats and payroll, sad CIA agents, and National Enquirer headlines obsessed with aliens. It is the voice of a poet who lovingly sifts through our life's junk and clutter for a few simple, reliable truths. His voice is humorous, but also humane. Finally, Kluhl's is a brave voice, risking sentimentality in poem after poem, and as Richard Hugo reminded us, if we're not risking sentimentality, we're not writing from the heart. David Kluhl's voice is straight from the heart. He is the author of 7 books of poems, including the National Poetry Series winner Blessings in Disguise, 2 book-length poems, The Conspiracy Quartet and Jack Ruby's America, and most recently, The Low End of Higher Things, which came out a couple months ago with University of Wisconsin Press. His poems have appeared in Poetry, the Kenyon Review, Harper's, the Georgia Review, and of course, River Styx. He teaches writing and literature at Webster University, where he also directs the undergraduate creative writing program. Please welcome our longtime friend and ally, David Kluhl.
Richard said the first thing you notice is the voice. Right now, tonight, I have a humidifier and a dehumidifier duking it out in the bedroom of my head, so I will try not to space it out too far. Thank everybody for coming on a very rainy night. I'd like to start with a new poem. As some people know, I'm kind of a dinosaur. I'm not a beat, but am kind of a dinosaur when it comes to machinery. I still like writing poems in longhand and like typing them on the typewriter. Unlike my friend and poet Albert Goldbarth, I won't say my fingers have never touched the keyboard of a computer, but close. This poem is called Meanwhile Back at the Typewriter, I'm Hoping for a Greater Acceptance. It begins with a quote of the kind that I've been getting more and more of. Anybody who has work accepted in magazines says, now that we're actually accepting your work, would you be so good as to send us copies on disk? I'm not sure I'll ever be that good. At best, I'm mostly reliable. From start to finish, a man of my typewritten word, tooling along behind the daisy wheel of my well-oiled Olivetti, which has no memory to speak of, which is a blessing given. Some of the things I've rolled out of there, looking impossibly good at 2 a.m., no one else on the road. Write me down as someone whose outmoded, unprocessed way with words still makes a measurable impression, at least on the paper, like Bigfoot, writ small, coming from nowhere, heading across that snowy expanse where anything's possible again, bringing even high-minded zoologists to their knees, something you could point to and actually feel. This poem would get its primordial ink on your fingers right now if it could. It would love nothing more than to rub up against you and be long. Hey, I sweated ampersands just finally going electric, plugging in like Dylan at Newport, 1965, when he nearly blew the sensitive fuses of all those acoustic folk song purists. I ain't gonna work on Maggie's farm no more. And I pounded out my own amped up anthem, but without the attendant booing, without thinking for a moment I was seriously Dylan. Beyond the desk lamp's suggestion of brilliance, I couldn't make out a single face where an audience should have been. There are lines, and then there are lines I will not cross. This typewriter never fails to beep its tiny horn, letting me know when I'm in danger of going too far again. I might yet have enough memory to include my home phone number, 961-388-something. And if anyone bothers calling to check up on me, I might put the receiver right next to the clack, clack, clacking of the keys, but only if the cord will stretch that far. Already, I can hear voices on the other end. You were right, honey, or Smithers, or Mr. President. He doesn't even have a portable phone. And once more, I'm a small throwback wonder, painfully quaint, as if I'd gone and set up shop next door to the taciturn blacksmith in some colonial Williamsburg beyond the pale of human understanding. Here's what I say. If I'm crazy, then please be good enough to think of me as crazy like a fox, the quick brown beast of ancient typewriter legend, maybe a step or two slower after so many years, but still all instinct and optic nerve. The look in his eye on his way to the henhouse glory is more hungry than playful. He needs the exercise. He's jumping over lazy dogs. He's talking his typewriter-written way in again, his mouth still so full of feathers from the last time he was this good, so good, almost too good to be true, and I'm not kidding this time either. You can take it from me, if you want, again. Glad that we're solidly a few years now into the new millennium and not debating whether it starts with 2000 or 2001, because finally there are fewer references in the daily prints to Nostradamus. Nostradamus was on every other television show, not he personally, but his wisdom. Nostradamus cited by everybody for everything. Nostradamus never claimed to know what his own prophecies meant. But he had an angle on something. This poem is called Nostradamus Had to Know. I'm betting skinny Nostradamus must have taken it on the chin more than once. That four-sided hat he sported wasn't big on the 16th century playground. It marked him as the bookish chump, an easy shakedown for another day's bus money. Never once voted most likely to succeed. Who could have predicted his enduring fame? Eternal, sweet revenge on those who made him take the long walk home. At first, he thought his legacy might be the excellent and most useful tract of everything needed for those who wish to become familiar with many choice recipes. His celebrated doctor's how-to manual of lozenges and lotions, powders and creams. But over 400 years later, we mostly go to Walmart for anything we need, although one diehard living descendant still hawks a line of Nostradamus jams and jellies. It's likely his parents never let up. Be a doctor, Nostradamus. And so he enrolled in the first course required then, astrology, which meant something half respectable in those days, observing and measuring planets and stars, a nascent form of astronomy still on the horizon. Astrology's lesser half assumed every spinning body put in its heavenly place for the benefit of the observer. And because this celestial display was getting easier to predict, someone imagined the world of human events should be equally foreseeable. That's all Nostradamus needed to know. The healing arts became less entrancing, paled by comparison with staring into candlelight until the afterimage burned in his eyes and convinced him that, because it was nothing he could otherwise name, what he was seeing had to be the future. And under the oblivious stars, he took to writing down his visions, always looking forward to their circulation among the very rich, who'd spend some big French coin for the services of a personal metaphysician. He never once claimed to know what any of his writings meant. From there, it wasn't much of a stretch. With no apparent talent, he still decided on a future in poetry. And then he was off to the visionary races, sweating out over 900 quatrains of events leading up to the planet's final days, which diligent Nostradamians through the ages dated anywhere from it really was a long way off 1999 to the safer boondocks of 3787. When it comes to making sense of what's ahead, Nostradamus had to know at least this much. There truly is no telling. And the book with anything that never occurred to him before in his life, published as the centuries, has never been for a moment out of print, never gone for long out of occult favor. It's still brimming with abstractions of the always popular natural disasters, wars, political upheavals in no particular chronological order. So much death and destruction by rampant metaphor, the assiduously vague, the unflinchingly equivocal. You'd think, for all the heavy psychic lifting, Nostradamus finally could have named some occasional names. Instead, that task has fallen to each successive generation, filling in the yawning blanks, making the nondescript shoe actually fit any one of history's convenient recent footprints, sized up wisely after the fact until it makes nothing but sense. One editor who'd solicited new prophecies was dismayed. Just got the two prognostications. I'm stupefied by your verbosity. Today, the fashion, use fewer words. Those quatrains were nothing like their attendant cover letter composed by Nostradamus's naturally sleek, meticulous prose. Maybe someone should have taken the prophet aside and clued him in. Homer, Dante, the Old Testament notwithstanding, this dogged insistence on verse almost always ends badly, and not only on the unforgiving playgrounds of the world after school. Generally speaking, there's no real future in it. And I can see Nostradamus undaunted, his prescient wisdom flashing his crooked schoolboy smile. Yes, but he has a certain gift where the future's involved. He's vigilant in seeing to it that he has one. Now he's picking up his hat off the ground again, placing it squarely on his head. He might not live to see it happen, but it's just a matter of time until his makeshift star ascends and takes its proper place, shimmering for all its worth at the height of wishful thinking. Song number after midnight. I pick up. The voice on the other end is already off and running. You were right, man. You were so incredibly right. And now I'm more than sorry I didn't believe you when you claimed the only way to keep their voices out of our heads was by using that heavy-duty aluminum foil, the kind our own mothers were crazy for when it came to preparing leftovers for their deep-freeze oblivion. You tried to tell me regular foil's too thin for making any kind of proper headgear. Ponderous buffer zone helmet, something less obtrusive, more stylish, say, even a wave-deflecting beret. And next time I visit, I'll be sure to bring enough of the extra strength for us both. And although this sounds like something I certainly might have suggested, perhaps only to my closest friends, it's true, it happens that I didn't. And finally, he stops to worry up a whisper. This isn't my friend Stuart, is it? And I say, no. And he says, oh, my God, man, they've gone and gotten through to you, haven't they? As if he's the one who can't believe what he's hearing, who's never felt so disconnected, standing in the middle of whatever room he's renting in his suddenly less than accommodating life. There's no way he can appreciate how accidentally he's reached me, how sympathetic I really am, the one other person who might think, yes, it's worth trying. This last-ditch defense against the aliens or the in-laws or those frightening late-night infomercial people. It's after midnight again, when everything that comes along is that much harder to resist, and where I've come to live more often than I'd like, just a single touch-tone button away, apparently, from the madhouse. I'm so awake now in the dark, it's not funny, and there's nothing left to say along the miles of open line. Nothing to do but quietly lay down the receiver in its cradle, take the long walk back to sleep. And if I make it that far again tonight, you can be absolutely sure that's when the Venusian scout ships will be closing in. Or Patricia's mother. And somewhere, Mr. Carwax Guru will be setting a Chevrolet on fire to the paid-off astonishment of his TV studio audience. One more brilliant lesson in the virtue of sheer resilience. And he'll swear nothing else on earth can stand up to that kind of heat. But three of us, more or less, in our foil-wrapped American as baked potato wisdom, we'll know better. There's me, my wrong number friend, and Stuart, wherever he is right now. May his meds make him unbreakable, and doctors never talk him fully out of his half-baked, hard-won silence. May his friends wait until morning, though, before ringing through to him there. And let the plans of the space people and our relatives and anyone else who would come to us in our woozy sleep on this night at least come to naught. May they be foiled with any luck, and with our blessings or our curses foiled again. May it turn out they've been looking all along for someone else. And if they find us instead, certifiable wrong numbers, may they have to tell us exactly how sorry they are and for how much. Given the crush of increasingly unstable particles in the universe, it's no small thing how surprisingly undisturbed we actually are, how quiet it so often is on our end of the line. And whenever we get to thinking, that's okay, there's quite enough still ringing in our ears for one more night, or for a lifetime, here comes another one of those voices out of nowhere saying, in so many words, we haven't heard anything yet. Yes. If they don't get you by telephone, they'll get you by any other waves they can beam into the room. It must have been that story on the late night TV news about the guy they caught on tape who said he'd gladly pay $10,000 to get rid of his wife, no questions asked, if whoever's on the other end of the phone knows what he means. That got you wondering out loud on your way to sleep, but you still love me, right? I should have smiled or somehow sighed dreamily or shot back the same question lovingly to you. But my head was reeling. 10-car pileups, drive-by shootings, Ebola, E. coli, hostage situations, the latest computer virus, armies on the march in some burgeoning far-flung country, smart bombs, dumb luck Republicans, and mad cow disease, more than anyone's daily minimum requirement of vicarious suffering and indifference. I suspected your question wasn't merely rhetorical, that probably you were counting on a fast, enthusiastic yes, which was exactly the answer I had in mind at last, when the weatherman appeared with his arsenal of maps, numerical mumbo-jumbo, and the usual grandiloquent weather-related gestures. For all that, the weather takes longer than ever to arrive with anything we can use, but at least no one's dead of meteorological causes tonight in his world, where disasters are only natural. When he says we're sitting under a dome of high pressure, he means that only in his weathermanly way. It's a good thing for us, and he'll be back with our forecast in just a moment. Meanwhile, I'm wondering, if that guy on the phone really would have shelled out more than they'd spent on the wedding, because maybe he was counting on some big insurance money, more than enough to show the formidable redhead he sees each week in payroll. She could be the new Mrs. Yehoo now, if only she'd stop pretending men like him don't even exist. From the little I know, and none of that from experience, it almost never works. And suddenly I understand your question. On another night, it could have been mine. So simple, yes, the single thing none of us can honestly stop asking ourselves about whoever's nestled so tightly inside those naturally percussive chambers of the heart that we can't help feeling even the faintest inadvertent slight or slightest hammer pressure might really be enough to set some volatile charge in motion. And then what do we do about the gaping hole in the roof when the rain comes, finally pouring down? Yes, no wonder the small voice best kept inside that means nothing really and so much at once sometimes gets out. Not because anyone's looking for trouble, but how about just a touch of harmless reassurance that, yes, we truly are in this preposterous world together, still in this sturdy bed on the same reliable side of love. Now the weatherman's back with all we've been waiting for. Yes, what it's going to be like where we live for the next 5 days, at least. As far as he can tell, at least. And when he calls it weather to die for, he's saying there's no way we won't love tomorrow, whatever's headed our direction next. Yes, I could have told you that much, and should have, gladly, before you drifted off beside me without any answer. And I'm left talking to myself and this sports guy who always knows a winning team when he sees one, although it's true he has the luxury of a teleprompter and his own fat stack of notes. If this last half hour had been secretly recorded, you'd hear the gray-white noise of those stories I got lost in. And then, after the overblown weather, finally a voice, grateful, relieved, a little embarrassed, more than sometimes I can say. I'd have the authorities play it over and over until you were sure when you woke up in the morning. That was, unquestionably, me. The editor asked me if I was interested in doing a short guide to poetry that they wanted to put out, like, seemed to me like flash maps of New York City, little things that fold in half and stay dry in the rain. I said, all of poetry? He said, well, as much as you know. I said, well, that sounds like trouble. He said, well, how about a particular poet? Is there a poet you like? William Carlos Williams. We got Wallace Stevens. How about you sound like a Wallace Stevens guy? That sounds like trouble. And I kept saying this to him and finally said, no, thank you. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, rather sarcastically, he said, if we ever do a pocket guide to trouble, you're the guy, okay? This poem's called A Pocket Guide to Trouble. And I dedicate it to the spirit, not in the sound of Wallace Stevens, but it's in 13 short parts, and he appears at the very end, since that was the last part of the conversation with this editor. There's a rather famous portrait of Wallace Stevens photo, silver-haired poet or businessman or both, depending. He comes in at the very end. A Pocket Guide to Trouble. 1. Genesis, Making Trouble. In those first days on the job, when God was just a beginner in a hurry, no real resume to speak of, when finally it was light enough for him to see what he was doing, surely he must have been thinking, don't let there be trouble. But he blew the line when he delivered the official out loud word of God, and there was trouble. He had all the time in the world, but no one knew yet how long that would turn out to be. And after the backbreaking week he'd put in already, he wasn't about to start over. 2. The epistemology. If it looks like trouble and it sounds like trouble and you can't stop yourself from asking everyone you see what exactly seems to be the trouble, then okay, this time it's absolutely going to be trouble, or else another one of those goddamn less than obvious ducks. Three, the mechanics of trouble. From the look on your face, I'm guessing it's major car trouble, transmission, brakes, or engine. But even a cracked block is nothing compared to woman trouble, heart trouble you can put a proper name to, the kind that's guaranteed to really set you back. It's the labor, not the parts. We'll get to you one way or the other first thing in the morning. We'll let you know whatever we find that's not quite beyond repair. You'll tell us what you can and can't afford. Four, commuters in trouble. Odysseus found himself going to an awful lot of it just trying to get home. Jimmy Stewart, too, near the end of It's a Wonderful Life. Five, the worst ever political advice, U.S. edition, expressed here as a trouble-filled couplet of epic proportions. Let Nixon be Nixon. Six, at the border of Switzerland in trouble. Even with millions of those red army knives and no standing army to speak of, the Swiss have somehow managed to stay out of it. Seven, theatrically speaking, we've got trouble. Right here in River City, where the deja vu and blue hair community players never seem to run out of musicals. Or else they do. And believe me, that's trouble too. With a capital T that rhymes with D, and that stands for Death of a Salesman, which they've overhauled, lightened up, led to its song and dance slaughter. In the moving words of Willie Loman's wife, attention must be paid, although she sings them now in some unaccountably jaunty calypso fashion. Willie's thankfully still a salesman by day, but he's moonlighting as, of all things, an amateur thespian. Every night he brings down the house, desperately invoking his imagined former glory. They love me in Oklahoma. Eight, trouble knows a few tricks. Because my novelist friend is a fan of those huge 19th century novels, he named his enormous real-life dog Trouble, as in Trouble climbed into bed with us this morning. Call for Trouble, and he comes. Sits, lies down, but he won't roll over, won't play dead for anyone. Not as long as he still remembers every bone he's ever buried with a real-life vengeance. Nine, what is the sound of questions getting harder? A Buddhist who isn't sure about the sound of two hands clapping is clearly a Buddhist already in trouble. 10, the classic overachiever. Jesus facing the multitude with five loaves and two fishes long before the advent of coleslaw as a side dish. Predictably, another miracle, no trouble at all. 11, sometimes trouble isn't on the menu. Like decent pizza in Nebraska, by now you should know better than to go asking for it. 12. Like the mountain coming to Muhammad, trouble will certainly find you. It knows where you live. Sooner or later, the roof will spring its leak, the stove go out for good, the bedroom door fall off its hinges, and the water in the toilet won't stop running, no matter how religiously you jiggle. And suddenly, trouble is an uncle with nothing better to do, waiting up in the dark for as long as it takes you to come back, if that's how it has to be. He's finished with following you. He'll be easing into your favorite slippers, lifting a few fingers of your highfalutin scotch. He'll have you down cold. Even the nervous humming will be pitch perfect. There's no way you'll be able to say that you like what he's done with the place, but you still can't help admiring how he's made himself this much at home. 13, always a troubling number. Don't let that silver-haired Mr. Businessman's demeanor fool you. Wallace Stevens was out there bird-dogging for us all. He knew 13 surefire ways of looking for trouble, including his favorite, shouting, "Hey, you skinny, uninsured sons of bitches," at the thin men of Haddam, Connecticut. This is with a poem called Desperate Measures that begins with an epigraph about Black Bart. People know who Black Bart was, Charles Bolton. He's the most famous and successful robber of Wells Fargo stagecoaches, and his calling card essentially was to leave a little ditty, a little piece of doggerel, something that he liked to call with a smile on his own face, poetry, in the strong box that later the authorities would find. The poem is Desperate Measures. Charles Bolton, a.k.a. Black Bart, robbed 28 Wells Fargo stagecoaches, often leaving a taunting verse in the plundered strongbox. Upon his release from San Quentin, he assured the warden that his life of crime was over. Asked if he was still going to write poetry, Bolton said, "I repeat, sir, I am through with my life of crime." Part of me feels really bad about this, but it's too late. There's no turning back now. Here comes one more no-account poem that someone with nothing to lose is waving in your face, and it's time to reach for the blue sky again. Sadly, there's no way of knowing if the poem's actually loaded or not. It could be just a bar of soap carved into the plausible shape of a poem, or a dime store water pistol knockoff of the real thing, although history doesn't seem to favor jumping to those reckless conclusions. I say, better to play it safe. No one's going to get hurt tonight if you listen carefully. Remember the cardinal rule the boss recited on your first night of clerking at the Gas and Go. There's no arguing with a poem. It's too easy to get messed up, and for what when you get right down to it? Give the guy with the poem anything he asks for. Whatever you do, please don't misunderstand what this is all about. I want the full attention of your life right up to this nerve-wracking moment. Give me everything you've got. Don't be caught dead on the business end of an extended metaphor. This is what happens when an unwitting public crosses over into literature's high-crime neighborhood. Although I'm guessing you have at least some pop gun verse of your own, holstered, convenient, within reach. These days, who isn't packing a version of poetry heat? You wanted to feel the sensation of running just once with that wrong crowd. Don't even think about it if you know what's good. I have bigger things still in my coat pocket, a ballad that doesn't know when to quit, an epic in heroic couplets that would absolutely blow you away. So don't go somehow thinking the world needs your heroics, too. Now step away from the page, nice and slow, no cause for alarm. You've stared down the dark barrel of sawed-off inspiration long enough, and you're going to live to tell about it for all the good that does. As far as anyone else is concerned, this whole thing never happened. It never really does. Later, you can file a report with the glassy-eyed desk cop or your local community college professor of English. They're not about to put a stop to any of this senseless poetry violence. They've been on the take for years, paid to look the other way. They need the small-time, good-for-nothing hoodlum likes of me. I'm their business, and that's not saying much, but it's a modest living for us all. I can promise you this, it won't be long until I'm giving myself up to the authorities again, to anyone who'll listen, and as usual, they'll have no idea what in the world I'm talking about. That's why I need you out there. That's why I'm letting you go. I'm telling you, word for adamant word, what I told you the last time. Generally, I work alone. So this has to be the end of the line, where we take one last deep breath together before making our separate tracks back into the silence, each of us imagining what we just got away with, at least for another few minutes, in the middle of our unsuspected lives.
Thank you very much.
Book is for sale just over there in the corner. We'll be right back with Act Two and Stephen Dankins.